This is Steve Weiss, and welcome to the latest episode of Taking It to the Street. It's December 20th, 2021, getting close to the end of the year. And for those of you, the astute listeners I'll refer to you as, you'll notice that Jim Labenthal is not with me today. Now, relax, Jim and I have not separated, not gotten divorced, not canceled our friendship. Jim just decided he needed a break. So Jim is out there in Utah somewhere, skiing downhill. We don't know if he's going faster downhill than the market and stocks. We don't even know if he's on the bunny hill or if he's on the expert slopes. I'd like your guess, though, because I know I've got my view. But while I'll miss Jim today, the upside is that there's nobody there to disagree with my eternal wisdom. There's nobody here to tell me that my language is a bit too expressive, or as Jim the Sailor would say, a bit too salty. After all, he would intone, this is a family show, and you know what, maybe it is. But, truth be damned, I'll talk like I want. So, let's get to the market, and it was another red day, another sea of red. I'm channeling Jim there again. All 11 sectors were down. Now, the market tried to bounce towards the end of the day, but what was most interesting is the reason that was some were saying that the market was down. Some were saying that, hey, it's because Joe Manchin is not voting for Build Back Better, that he pulled the plug on. He's just fed up and said, you know what, pulling my hair out here, trying to negotiate with the White House. So some were attributing the market's decline to that. I personally think that's ridiculous. In fact, in a vacuum, I believe that Joe Manchin's actions would have led to an up market today. Why? Because even the most benign politician, by that I mean not the radical right, not the radical left, not the grandstanders, but the ones that looked at this objectively, would say, you know what, this could be inflationary, number one, and number two, it's going to add massively to the federal deficit, put us further in debt as a country, which we can't tolerate right now. And that would have been the right call. Now, I'm not opining on whether it was a great plan or whether it was a bad plan. In fact, I think that there are some segments of the population that desperately need help and desperately deserving of help. And that, in fact, if you provided that help, perhaps in the form of child care credits, selectively disseminated, that it would be positive for the economy. And the human value would be positive of that. It would allow people to get child care, which would free them up to then pursue employment. And with employment, with labor being in such a severe shortage right now, that would have been very positive. And maybe that's not gone. Maybe they'll figure out a way to bring that back. Maybe I'll be somewhat political with my next statement, but there were socialistic tendencies evident in the bill. And that was, well, take a topic we'll discuss going forward in the form of Tesla, but maybe that was the $12,000 tax credit for buyers of union-produced EVs. Clearly, that borders on socialism. So I'm glad that's not in there. I'm glad some other things are not in there. I'm not happy some things aren't in there, like the aforementioned child credit. But all that aside, I believe that the reason for the market decline continues to be Omicron and COVID overall. So Omicron, as my daughter who lives in London told me, Omicron is the way they say it in England. Omicron is the way they say it in the U.S. That's the issue with the market. It's the concern that the closures that we saw in the Netherlands and have been rumored in the U.K. and the factory closings that we've seen in China, albeit small but nonetheless taking place, will spread to the U.S. even though, to my knowledge, there's no plan to shut anything down here. There's no appetite for a lockdown on anybody's part, and I don't see it happening. But there are concerns that could happen elsewhere in the world. And what would that do? That would exacerbate our supply chain issues. It would exacerbate the inflation issues. And it just wouldn't be good. So that's the issue that's hanging over the market. Now, we know that, or we believe that, I won't say we know because we definitely don't know, that the symptoms are less severe. That's being questioned by everybody that's a scientist because there's no data for that yet. They point to South Africa, but that's a younger population. So you would see less severe symptoms. So we need to see how it works through the system. And we're just at the front end of that. And then we'll see these holiday gatherings, and those could be super spreading events. Just as a small analogy, my cousin went to his office holiday party, 125 people there. He didn't want to go, but felt some pressure to. 40 out of the 125 were diagnosed after positive tests with COVID. The party was Friday night. The results of the tests were on Tuesday, and it may have grown further, but 40 out of 125, think about that. We see the toll it's taking on professional sports with moving NFL games, with closing or canceling, postponing, whatever term you want to use, NHL, NBA. It's a real issue. So if you can postpone professional sports events, why couldn't you shut down factories? So that's the fear that's riding over the market for the last week and culminating, I believe, today. So what will cause that to end? Well, unfortunately, that's not the biggest issue. The other issue is the Fed. I don't recall ever seeing the Fed in a tougher place. We're not seeing inflation solely increase because of demand, because money's so cheap, and money's never been this cheap for as long. That's not the only reason we're seeing inflation. We're seeing inflation because the supply chain is still impinged. Goods are not flowing as easily as they should. So people are paying up for it. I went online to look at just a Bronco. 6-month wait for delivery. 6 months. I don't recall seeing that. Sure, you see that in some of the higher-end cars with limited production, but this should be a major mass-produced vehicle. But it's not only with Broncos. It's with all cars. Very difficult to get it. Why? Because of the supply chain. Because they can't get chips. So today, Ford announced they're cutting back production yet again. Whereas others have said, hey, it's over. Well, it's not over. It's not close to being over. As a matter of fact, the freight companies that I talk to say they haven't really seen it improve at all. So you've got COVID, you've got the supply chain, and you've got the Fed, as I started to say, in a very difficult spot. Arguably, even if they raise rates, it's not going to help calm inflation. Unless they raise them significantly where they absolutely kill demand and push us closer to recession. That's not their goal. That's not what they're going to do. So while rate increases will be pulled forward, in my belief, and we've been on record as saying this before, to the first half of next year, and while I believe it's very likely we see 3 rate increases next year, you'll still have incredibly and historically cheap money. But the fear is of an economic slowdown, and that was no more evident than in what we saw in 10-year yields today, where yet again, they were down. They touched, I believe, a 1.35 today before rallying towards the end of the day. Yields rallying, bonds selling off, which is more reasonable given what Powell told us last Wednesday. So yields closed over a 1.41, I believe. I believe directionally that'll continue. But look no further for the reason that the market declined and why the market came off its lows than bond yields. So what will we get near term? Well, after the close today, we saw 2 great earnings reports. We saw Micron, part of strong numbers, so that stock is up about 6%. We saw Nike, similar report, a strong quarter. That stock's up about 3%. The point is, they're up, not down. They surprised to the upside. Now, we're not going to get many other earnings reports being in the last week of the year. So let me wrap up market for you today. What's going on? So we've got inflation, which isn't under control. We've got tight labor, which isn't under control. We've got COVID. We don't know how that's going to turn out. We've got a Fed that's in a very, very tough place. And then we've got what perhaps the most important data point I've seen in a long time. And that data point is inflows. Global equity inflows in 2021 exceeded $1 trillion. That in itself is not that important until you take a look at what that's measured against. And that $1 trillion is more than the cumulative global inflows over the last 19 years into equities. Now, if Isaac Newton, Sir Isaac Newton, were your strategist, your equity strategist, instead of one of the typical cheerleaders that we see talking the market's going to go up tomorrow, going to go up the next day, next week, next month, next year, next decade, next millennium. If it were Isaac Newton, he would say, what goes up must come down. So the question you have to ask yourself, is that $1 trillion? Is that $1 trillion coming from, did it come from diamond hands or did it come from paper paws? By definition, a number of investors or traders put that money in near the top of the market and have not gotten paid for it. And as a matter of fact, if you ignore the indices themselves, which are not that far off their all-time highs, and you look at stocks that perhaps that they went into, like maybe it's Tesla that's down from 1,200 to 900, or maybe it's CrowdStrike that's down from what, 300 to 200, or maybe Unity down from 220 to 140. If it went in there, how patient will these investors be? Will they think they're foolish for getting in at the top of the market and look to sell? Or is part of that money from people that have done well that take a longer-term time frame but just said, you know what, this is as good as it gets. I can't expect another year like 2020 and 2021 in the market. So I'm taking some of my chips and going home. I don't know that, but usually the market does have some reversion to the mean. But here's the good news. Markets don't stay down for long unless you come out of 2000 where everything was in a bubble and it took 10 years for the NASDAQ to regain its prior highs. No, markets generally are somewhat rational. I think the days, however, of the V-shaped recoveries where it's down 10% in a week and then it's up that 10%, recovers in a few days, I don't think we're going to see that anymore. Furthermore, being at the end of the year and everybody and their in-laws calling for a Santa Claus rally, well, let me digress for a sec. We had that Santa Claus rally. And Christmas is a one-day holiday, maybe a day and a half if you count Christmas Eve. The rally mirrored that. The rally was a one-day rally on the heels of Chairman Powell giving his outlook for rates in response to questions and the dot plot that we got accompanying the press release from the Fed last Wednesday. So where does that leave us? It leaves us with lots of negatives, not all of which I'm sure have been digested by the market. It leaves us with volatility and expect that volatility continue to go forward. Now, tomorrow may be a green day because, as I mentioned, we got Nike and we got Micron, and stocks always look for a reason to go up, and they go down because nobody's expecting all this bad news. But I still think it's a tough time. I just believe that portfolio managers have had a pretty rough year. I know I have in terms of being tired. It's been a good year. Everybody's made money. But how willing are people going to be, probably taking the last few days off, to put on new positions going into the end of the year? I'm just not sure they will. So I think we're in this volatile period. It's going to continue. There should be a bounce. Tomorrow, looks like to me, will be the bounce. And then we'll take it from there. But I'm not going to say definitely. I started to, but I caught myself. We're not going to see the market just run away from us here. And in terms of individual stocks, they are the real story. And you could pick a sector and you'll see stocks that have gotten crushed. And maybe they're good opportunities to buy them. Maybe they're not. But let's talk about one in particular. Let's talk about Target. Now, I sold half my Target position at higher levels, not tremendously higher, but higher. And why did I do that? Well, it was acting like a piece of crap, number one. Apologies to Jim, you're not here to put guardrails on me. But yeah, it was acting like a piece of crap. And why was that? Well, business should be good. I believe it's because if you look at earnings forecast for Target, you'll have down earnings next year. And this is not just true of Target. It's also true of Dick's Sporting Goods. You'll have down earnings for next year. And then you'll have flat earnings for the next couple of years. And you'll have flat EBITDA for the next few years. So you would need multiple expansion for the stock to go higher. Now, could they report up earnings next year? Sure. Are they going to blow it out versus this year? And keep in mind that retailers generally operate under a January fiscal year, so they capture more accurately the Christmas season and the returns. But I just don't see it. So I will tell you, at 220, which is where the stock is right now, versus 260, which is where it was, it's a hell of a lot cheaper despite earnings estimates not coming down. I just don't know where it bottoms. I would like to add to it. But I look at a stock like Dick's Sporting Goods, which really, I wouldn't say they have the sporting goods market to themselves, but they are definitely the dominant player. And Dick's was a lot cheaper at 140 at the top than it was at 120. How do I say that? Why do I say that? How can that be true? Well, here's why it's true. And I'm going to give you some numbers that are not exactly accurate here, but directionally they are accurate. Here's why it's true. When Dick's was trading at 120, for argument's sake, let's say the earnings were $10 a share. When the stock was trading at 140, it was right after they reported earnings, and management said, we're going to earn $14 a share. So at 120 on $10 earnings, it was 12 times. The PE was 12. At 140, on $14 of earnings, the PE was 10 times. So while the stock went up, it was a lot cheaper. Conversely, when you take a look at some other stocks, and this always just gnaws at me, when somebody says, well, the stock's down 50%, it's gotten so much cheaper. No. If the stock's down 50% and the earnings are down 60%, it's gotten more expensive. So you have to look at valuation, not what's happened to the stock. So in any event, I prefer to own Dick's Sporting Goods than I do Target, which is the reason why I sold half my Target and not sold Dick's. Dick's management came out on Friday, so we're going to add another $2 billion to the buyback. The executive chairman came out and bought $3 million worth of stock in the open market. That's not small change for anybody, except perhaps for Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos. That's a meaningful investment in a company where the chairman already owned a lot of stock. But let's move on. I do want to address the Fed for a little bit, go back into it, and why they're in such a tough place. And I mentioned it's because of inflation. So they've got a dual mandate. Number one is price stability, inflation. The other is labor. Under anybody's judgment, I believe we're at full employment. So now they're focusing on inflation. And I just don't see how they can bring it under control. And that gives me some concerns. I don't think Jay Powell is going to go out there and going to raise rates and kill all demand, push us into recession. But what it does mean to me is that that Fed put that we've been living with almost since 2008, the housing crisis, no longer exists. Jay Powell is not going to reverse course and say, you know what? I was only kidding about that rate hike. I was only kidding about being hawkish. Take it easy. That Fed put's there if you need it. He's not going to do what he did in 2018, where he raised rates, only having to come back and say, hey, that was a mistake. Didn't say it exactly, but that was the messaging. So that's why I have some concerns. Can the market still go up? Of course it can. Will the market go up? Well, markets, those cheerleading strategists are absolutely right. Markets go up more often than they go down. In fact, 90% of the time. So yes, from a long-term standpoint, I'm still very positive on the market. I'm still positively disposed to the market. I'm in about 30, 35% cash. I'd like to deploy it. I'm not deploying it now because while some stocks have come my way, I'd rather miss the first 10% in the upside than catch the next 20% in the downside. So this is a very tough period for investors. And if you take a very long term, sure, go put money in the market. If you prefer to be a little more careful about when you're deploying capital because your returns are measured by your point of entry, then maybe you want to wait a little bit, or maybe you just want to tiptoe in. So that's how I would look at the market. That's my advice. Let's turn to another topic here, and this is sort of a pet peeve of mine. What I'm talking about specifically is the underbelly of the market. What happens behind the scenes? I had a fund where my fund would sue companies that sold themselves, that went private, sold to private equity or sold to management for less than they were worth. And the question always came up from people not in the business that didn't know what I did. Why would anybody do that? Why would a board of directors sell a company for less than it's worth? Number one, I'll say this without fear of contradiction, that I believe that most boards are not independent. As a matter of fact, where you have strong founder companies, they've picked the boards. As a matter of fact, where you have other companies, publicly, large publicly traded companies, and the CEO is chairman of the board, chairperson of the board, No board member is going to come to the board unless they're aligned with the CEO. So let me give you a couple of examples of what I'm talking about. I've got so many stories to share about the underbelly of Wall Street, about the seedy side of the street of that walk down Wall Street, that perhaps I'd need a whole separate series of podcasts to go through them all. And I'd never run out of material because they happen every day. But today, I'm just going to talk about one thing in particular, and that is insider trading, which is still alive and well, thank you, on Wall Street in public equities. It's perhaps very newsworthy today when the FBI brought charges against some of Putin's cohorts for insider trading, allegedly having access through hacking to corporate information and then trading on that information, as if Putin needs more money. I don't think he does. He's one of the wealthiest guys in the world. Although, we don't see his tax returns, but I have that in pretty good information. In any event, there's a five-day period, apparently, between when a company signs a deal to be acquired and when it has to make that disclosure to the public. Leading up to that date of signing the documents, lots of negotiations go on, and it's pretty much known at some point way before those documents are signed that this deal is going to take place, with the last bit of information between the parties being the exchange of documents for lawyers to put the fine print on and then for everybody to sign and for the board to vote on, which presumably they've done in advance of the final documentation. So let's say that happens on January 1st. January 5th comes along, and now they've got to disclose it to the public. In between that period, I've noticed a lot of insider trading. I had breakfast with former SEC Commissioner Rob Jackson, who's just a great person. And before he joined the SEC, he was a professor at NYU Law School. And when I bring up some of these instances of insider trading, I'll give you one specific one in a moment. He told me we noticed the same thing. As a matter of fact, when I was a professor, I and my assistant put together a list of 800 instances of insider trading by managements and boards. We put it on a website. We sent the list to the SEC, and they pursued one. And I said, why is that, Rob? And he said, well, for a few reasons. Number one, CEOs, CFOs, board members, they can retain expensive counsel. And this counsel does what he called papering over the allegations. So in other words, they would keep sending motions to the court to delay the proceedings, to delay the lawsuits, to delay the enforcement of the laws. And ultimately, eventually, the SEC staff would turn over. And somebody would come in and say, wait a second, this insider trading complaint, this is going to do nothing for my career. I'm looking for big fish to fry. I'm looking for that Putin case. I'm looking for something that's really going to get my name out there so I will pave my way to a big cushy job with private on the private side at a big law firm, a white shoe law firm where I could be part and make a lot of dough. Also, the SEC is notoriously understaffed. So even though they have this surveillance technology, you still have to move forward after it picks something up. So instead, they charge to go after the big visible insider trading cases, hopefully sending a message that they will pursue everybody, similar to what the IRS does, by the way, where they can't afford to go after everybody who cheats on their taxes. They prefer to go after the big people. So it trickles down. So that's why the SEC doesn't pursue it. But specifically, what I'm referring to is a case where this company was being driven by activists to sell the company to another company. They estimated that the company was worth $58, $60 a share. The stock traded into the mid-50s. The CEO sold stock at $53 a share. I'm giving you estimates, but I think that's pretty accurate. 3 days later, the company was sold for $48 a share, a 10% discount to where the CEO sold. How do I know the CEO sold stock? How do I know when the CEO sold stock? Because it was in the Form 4 documents that were filed that nobody looked at. So in the Form 4, it says the date, it says the price, it says the number of shares. Now, you can't tell me that there was not an agreement to sell the company that was signed and sealed. In fact, there was, because the documents were also available. So the CEO, knowing that the company would be taken under, in other words, sold at a price below the market price, went out and sold stock. I informed the SEC about it. To date, there's been nothing done, and I'm not going to hold my breath. Now, you ask, if this is happening, and it's more than an isolated instance, why don't the index funds do anything about it? After all, they own more than 50% of every publicly traded company. Why don't portfolio managers and active funds do anything about it? The answer is, and I've spoken to basically all the large index funds on this issue and other governance issues, they can't afford to. Their margins are so narrow that they do not want to go out and hire attorneys to pursue these claims, number one. Number two, they don't really care. As long as their competing index funds are getting the same price, that same $48 that they're getting, that's all they care about. They don't care that it was worth $60, $70, or even $100. They only care what's the competition getting. So you pick an index fund based upon its performance, how it's done versus the others, and what its cost is. And if those costs are inflated by legal fees for pursuing litigation about crooked CEOs and crooked board members, you're not going to care about that. You're not going to know why they're high. So they want to keep those low. Plus, they don't want to go out and hire people, which also adds to their cost and hits into their profit margins, to oversee this litigation. They've got other things to do, such as creating new funds. So why don't active portfolio managers pursue it? Same reason. Number one, their average size position, the average portfolio manager in an active fund owns about 100 positions. So on average, this would be a 1% position. So even if they got 20% more for the company after suing, they've spent all that time going after the company. They've spent that money on legal fees. Say it was done in contingency. The lawyers did it for the recovery. But it wouldn't move the needle, the recovery. 20 basis points that would have to, you know, take years to resolve just doesn't mean it. So in the meantime, you have this underbelly of the market where you can have crooked CEOs and crooked board members taking advantage of the average shareholder. And that's a minor, frankly, infraction. I've got much bigger ones, and I'll share those with you maybe next time out, if Jim allows me. Now let's turn to Tesla. Tesla, I think their best days are behind it from a competitive standpoint. Keep in mind that when Elon Musk launched his company, and he's brilliant, he deserves everything he earns. I say that for two reasons. Number one, he created a category. He's helping to save the earth. And number two, if he earned less, it's not like it's coming into my pocket, so I could care less. But Tesla, for the last, whatever, 6 years, 8 years, decades since they've been in business, they've sold into a vacuum of competition. So there have been no other EVs out there. And while part of the bear argument has always been more competition coming, well, that was premature, but competition is here. And not only is competition here in terms of offering the consumer more choices, it's here in the form of much bigger advertising budgets than Tesla has. Tesla doesn't really advertise. Tesla doesn't have a dealer network. But GM, Ford, Nissan, Porsche, Volkswagen, Hyundai, Rolls-Royce, Ferrari. Well, maybe Rolls-Royce doesn't advertise. Maybe Ferrari doesn't advertise. But the others certainly advertise quite a bit. And they have massive budgets. Their ads are on the Super Bowl. Their ads are on The Bachelorette and The Bachelor, two of Jim's favorite shows. They're everywhere. How can Tesla compete with that? Ads drive consumption. Ads drive business. Tesla's going to have to advertise. Now, the other thing is their model is kind of old. They haven't changed the style of their cars since they launched. It's not what they do. But I don't know about you, but I know when my lease is up, and sometimes I own the car, sometimes I lease it. When my lease is up, I like new. I like getting into a different design car. So I'm looking for that new model. Even if it's the same car that I have, but refreshed, I want that. Don't you think there's a segment of Tesla drivers that while they love the car, they may not appreciate the fact that it's sort of not a lot of luxury in those cars? not a lot of bells and whistles, and they could trade into an Audi that's just gorgeous with cushy seats, great luxury, and other accessories that just make it more exciting, more comfortable, more fun. And when you have a problem with your car, and while Teslas are largely problem-free, don't you want to be able to drive to a dealer network that's 2 or 3 miles away and say, hey, you take a look at this. And they're going to take a look at it, and they're going to take a look at it for free while they're giving you a cup of coffee and a donut in the waiting room. Or maybe if you buy a car that costs what a high-end Tesla costs, they'll come to your house or your apartment and pick it up. That's what Elon's going to have to compete against. So what does that mean? That means that margins are going to come down. That means that Ford, which is at a 9 multiple, or a Volkswagen, which is at a 7 multiple, is going to do better as a stock going forward than Tesla at a 100 multiple. So again, look, I love Tesla cars. I've driven them, don't own one, thought of buying one, but living in the Northeast with what cold weather does to battery life if you park it outside, and with my having range phobia, I haven't done it yet. But I love the car. Friends of mine all love it. Nobody has a bad word to say about it. And I think Elon Musk did a phenomenal job. Doesn't mean it's going to be a great stock. So I'm going to leave you with those thoughts. Have plenty of other thoughts. But without Jim here, you know, I want to have something to say when he's back with me next week. So until next week, if you celebrate Christmas, I'm wishing you a Merry Christmas. I'm wishing you a happy holiday. Let's see how we can make the rest of this year work out for us as investors. Thanks so much for your time. I'm going to give Jim your regards.
Jim Labenthal is an investment advisor representative of Cerity Partners and holds the Chartered Financial Analyst designation. Jim Labenthal and Cerity Partners are unaffiliated with Stephen Weiss. The securities discussed in this podcast by Jim, unless otherwise stated to the contrary, are securities that Jim either manages within the current client portfolios or owned by Jim personally. You should not consider the information discussed as personalized investment, tax, or legal advice, or solicitation to buy or sell any specific security. There's no guarantee that views and opinions expressed in this podcast will come to pass or a guarantee of future performance. Investing involves risk, and before investing, you should consult a qualified professional advisor. Stephen Weiss is not a registered investment advisor and is not affiliated with any regulated entity. The views and opinions he expresses are his own and are not intended to be advice or recommendations. Stephen does not guarantee the accuracy of his statements or views. Investors should perform their own due diligence and not rely upon the information contained in this podcast as the sole basis for their investments.